Hello, and welcome back to the Caliphs, the rise and fall of Arab power. My name is Zayd Wahab, and today we're going to cover the entirety of Al-Muqtadir's long reign from the perspective of his wazirs. The title changed hands 14 times, so even this constrained scope will give us more than enough to talk about. The exceptional degree of administrative turbulence was largely due to corruption, as the position was sold and resold to various ambitious officials. Although a dozen different men will fill this critical role, only two of them were fit for the job, Ibn al-Furat and Ibn al-Jarrah. The other 10 were just there for the prestige, and, of course, the money. We suddenly find ourselves surrounded by a bunch of rich folks with nowhere near the amount of gold they seemed to need. Episode 83, War of the Wazirs. I keep running up against new difficulties with this part of our journey through the Caliphate's history. Getting used to unfamiliar sources is harder than it sounds, particularly at this beginning-of-the-end juncture we're at. Accounts of the period are often retrospective. They cherry-pick examples to justify a view or support an argument. It's valid historical analysis, much of it quite compelling, but it left me longing for something sweeping or panoramic. Another challenge was ordering the different subjects we'll cover during Al-Muqtadir's reign. The Caliphate's military was exceptionally active, and that is arguably more deserving of attention than today's topic. I ultimately chose to open with this because it shines a spotlight on the new administration's priorities. You'll never understand how the Abbasid Caliphate went bust without today's discussion. It also reveals how dysfunction at the top spread to the more critical aspects of government, something which will inform subsequent discussions. My plan is for us to go through Al-Muqtadir's 24-year reign wazir by wazir. We'll comment about what was going on every now and then, and that's where you'll want to look for substance, as the officials themselves were mostly fungible. Historical coverage of these figures varies, and therefore this compilation will be a little choppy as well. I'll make sure to address the secretarial rivalry as we go along, but don't expect anything dramatic. Ibn al-Furat and Ibn al-Jarrah were just two competent administrators who had different ideas on how to go about managing the state's finances. Some histories hype it up and make it seem like a central feature of Al-Muqtadir's reign. The actual story is unmitigated corruption on a scale never before seen in the Caliphate. Let's begin. Wazir number one, the man who swore Ja'far into office as Al-Muqtadir, was Abbas ibn al-Hasan al-Jarjarai. But as we heard, he died in the failed coup only 4 months later. I believe al-Abbas had no option but to elevate al-Muqtadir, and that weeks into his reign, Abbas worked to replace the caliph with Abdullah ibn al-Mu'taz. I'm not sure why he changed his mind at the last minute. A bribe sounds like a reasonable explanation. I'm only skeptical because I find it a little too on-brand for al-Muqtadir's reign. Maybe he realized they didn't stand a chance at replacing the caliph without the Turks on board. There's really no way to say. Whatever the case was, Abbas's co-conspirators killed him at the outset of their coup in December 908, and wazir number two was his secretary, Ali ibn al-Furat. Ibn al-Furat will be one of only two wazirs worth remembering. I plan to refer to the others by their numbers. His first tenure started out pretty well. Sources report the treasury at between 8 and 15 million gold dinar when the young caliph first assumed the throne in 908, and Ibn al-Furat added to it by dispossessing all the officials implicated in the failed coup. Other wins included a tidy sum from the reconquest of Fez and a settlement with the governor of Azerbaijan. This was all welcome news, because the ruling family had expensive tastes, and we find dozens of accounts about al-Muqtadir's extravagance. The waste is often reported as open-handed generosity, but in truth, the caliph was just rewarding those who had earned his, or more accurately, his mother's favor. By the year 912, the spending started to seriously concern Ibn al-Furat, because that was the first time the wazir turned down al-Muqtadir's request for more money. The caliph wanted the treasury to pay for A'id blowout, but Ibn al-Furat refused to release the sums necessary to fund it, suggesting that al-Muqtadir should use his own considerable wealth instead. This sealed the wazir's fate. Ibn al-Furat was apprehended while in his office by the hajib and dragged to jail. Ibn al-Furat's dispossession garnered over 1.5 million dinar, and many accounts are quick to accuse him of corruption. That may be a little premature, though. It's true he had a suspiciously large amount of money on him, but there are no further indications that he was mishandling the caliphate's finances. If anything, his dismissal depicts him guarding the ummah's wealth at great personal cost. My goal here isn't to vindicate Ibn al-Furat from corruption, but to highlight his MO because it is relevant to our discussion. This wazir had a very relationship-based management style. He sought to embed himself in the state by stacking it with loyal officials. The men he empowered had substantial autonomy so long as they consistently met Ibn al-Furat's expectations. It's all very reminiscent of how Qasim ran the state back in al-Muqtafi's days, and such a model suggests that the sum found in Ibn al-Furat's possession could have been for legitimate government operations. As you can imagine, the wazir's assertive approach alienated others who sought to exert their own influence, and Ibn al-Furat always had enemies in high places. Wazir number 3 was the son of al-Mutawakkil's wazir from way back in the 850s. This is the guy who first broke the bank. We are told number 3 paid the queen mother 100,000 dinar so she would lobby for his appointment. One of his first moves in office was to transfer another 1.6 million dinar from the public purse to the court's private account, way more than the sums his predecessor had been punished for refusing. We find anecdotes with descriptions of downright ridiculous corruption at the time. Number 3 realized that if he was willing to spend 100,000 dinar to buy his job, then his rich peers would probably pay just as much for other positions of influence. He sold these with reckless abandon, and some officials were replaced before they even had a chance to take up the posts they'd bought and paid for. 7 of the men who were promised Kufa banded together to petition for their bribes to be refunded, saying they only enjoyed 20 days to govern the city on average, nowhere near enough to recoup their investments. Number 3 also dropped taxes and loosened restrictions for a reasonable sum, a business-friendly attitude that swiftly eviscerated the economy. Prices shot up, revenue was down, and the wazir lost his job only 2 years into the gig when it became clear that the court needed someone serious at the wheel. Number 4 was none other than Ali ibn Isa ibn al-Jarrah, the only other competent wazir and foil to the disfavored Ibn al-Furat. While Ibn al-Furat is remembered for greasing palms and living large, Ibn al-Jarrah is depicted as an austere anti-corruption crusader. From that description alone, we can guess that he was going to have a difficult career ahead. While he did repeatedly butt heads with the prodigal ruling family, he actually ended up being al-Muqtadir's longest-serving wazir, albeit over multiple tenures. He technically held the role for a decade, while Ibn al-Furat enjoyed a total of 6 years, leaving only 8 to be divided among the rest. Ibn al-Jarrah first took the reins in the year 913, and he immediately busied himself with cleaning up the mess his inept predecessor had left behind. It was a losing fight from the outset. There was simply too much money at stake. Those whose privileges were under threat won the caliph over, and al-Muqtadir ordered his new wazir to honor all the contracts entered into by good old number 3. It was an imprudent decision that saddled the state with unnecessary debt and made Ibn al-Jarrah's job that much harder. While he fell short on that front, his tenure had other successes. Ibn al-Jarrah closed loopholes that improved revenue collection in some provinces and managed to direct that money to worthwhile causes, investing in civil infrastructure like water wells and hospitals. Actions like these are part of why he is remembered as the good wazir. But alas, he only lasted 4 years his first time. Bizarrely, he was brought down by almost the exact same conflict which led to the dismissal of Ibn al-Furat. When Eid came around in 917, the Abbasids asked for some extra dough to mark the occasion in style. The request didn't come from the caliph, but the queen mother's qahramana, Musa. This wasn't the first time she had come knocking, and one source quotes a long and polite letter Ibn al-Jarrah had addressed to Shaghab, asking her to please stop her surrogate from interfering in government business. Before we play Ibn al-Jarrah off stage for the sin of rebuffing the crown's agent, I want to highlight a couple of the policy decisions which set him apart from the only other wazir who matters. His focus on fighting corruption didn't mean that he had no allies in the state whatsoever. Ibn al-Jarrah had a faction of supporters and loyalists, much like the one Ibn al-Furat surrounded himself with. The main differences were that Ibn al-Jarrah did not engage in corrupt practices, while Ibn al-Furat was not above making backroom deals, so long as they helped him get the job done. Ibn al-Jarrah's reputation for honesty made him Mu'nis's preferred wazir, something which has given rise to a stubborn misconception in modern commentaries, namely that Ibn al-Jarrah sought to give as much of the state's revenue as possible to the military. It's a wild leap. There is so much material that blatantly goes against such characterizations. For example, one of the ways Ibn al-Jarrah saved money was by not paying the armies for extended periods of time, then negotiating a discount when the troops were getting desperate. That doesn't sound like someone who has the military's interests at heart to me. Some histories focus on this imagined preference and ignore a real one regarding the wazir's approach to the Qaramita. While all other wazirs left it up to the army to deal with them, Ibn al-Jarrah found it more efficient to pay the Qaramita off to keep the peace. Now that we know more about the differences between Ibn al-Furat and Ibn al-Jarrah, let's return to our narrative. Ibn al-Jarrah was removed in 917. Well, removed is putting it mildly. He was arrested after Shaghab's qahramana accused him of corruption, although tellingly, we don't find reports of any sums extracted from the austere figure. He was replaced by wazir number 5, his supposed rival, Ibn al-Furat. During his time away from power, Ibn al-Furat realized that all he had to do to get his job back was convince the ruling family that he was the key to their prosperity. They needed someone as competent as Ibn al-Jarrah, but who was also willing to play ball a little. Ergo, he, Ibn al-Furat, was the ideal candidate. We're told he reached an agreement to pay Al-Muqtadir 1,000 dinar and his mother another 500 every day he was in office. It's clear that corruption had been pretty much institutionalized by this point. Officials were regularly buying their positions and dispossessing their predecessors to generate income. Ibn al-Furat kept his word, but the New Deal didn't last very long. Like any good wazir, he tried to pursue those who had grown rich off government contracts. One of his targets, a wealthy landowner or tax farmer in Wasit named Hamid ibn Abbas, managed to turn the tables on him. Worried about paying the millions Ibn al-Furat was hounding him for, he sent messages to Shaghab, letting the Queen Mother know that he would be a far more profitable choice for wazir. Suddenly, the palace was awash with rumors that Ibn al-Furat was secretly conspiring to unseat al-Muqtadir. So, only a year and a half after getting the job, Ibn al-Furat was arrested and put on trial for treason. Wazir number 6 was Hamid, obviously, and he proved to be a total disaster right off the bat, as he had no clue what the position actually entailed. He was swiftly convinced to appoint the only other guy who could do the job as his deputy. Ibn al-Jarrah was thus fished out of prison and returned to duty. As you can imagine, the no-nonsense Ibn al-Jarrah clashed with number 6. But before we proceed with that, let's take a minute to hear about the trial of Ibn al-Furat. It took place at the outset of number 6's tenure, and the momentous proceedings drew the caliph's attendance. Al-Muqtadir was about 23 years old by now, and he begins to increasingly feature as an agent in accounts around this point. The eloquent Ibn al-Furat had an easy time defending himself against accusations of treason. There wasn't any evidence beyond a supposed witness, but his dubious story didn't hold up to Ibn al-Furat's cross-examination at court. The charges of corruption levied against him were more substantial, but here he expertly deflected by pointing to the wazir's own behavior in procuring his position. He added insult to injury by pointing out that number 6 had only done so after being pursued for tax evasion, suggesting that he had plenty more to hide. The tongue-lashing was more than the wazir could stand. He lost his cool and may have tried to physically assault the defendant, making a fool of himself and leading the caliph to bring proceedings to an end. In revenge, number 6 ordered the arrest of Ibn al-Furat's only son. He was tortured extensively until his father released hundreds of thousands of dinars to be paid as fines, supposedly vindicating the wazir's trial. Number 6 did pay a couple million into the treasury right after the embarrassing affair. The payment was either part of the bribe promised to the crown, or he was scandalized by the way Ibn al-Furat had called him out openly at court. He then proceeded to abuse his position to earn the sum back and keep his friends happy. Along with a handful of other rich investors, including Shaghab's agents, he cornered the market on grain in Baghdad. The diabolical plan was to create an artificial shortage in order to boost prices, but its inelegant execution left much to be desired. There were riots for days, police were killed, armed mobs emptied all the prisons and burned down the main bridges in the city. Troops had to be sent in to retake control, but the situation in Baghdad didn't calm down until Al-Muqtadir forced the grain silos to bring their goods to market. Number 6 became somewhat of a persona non grata at court, and he asked for permission to work remotely from Wasit soon after. When it came to administration, Ibn al-Jarrah was the actual wazir number 6. Well, Shaghab's entourage was quite dominant at this point too, but they exerted influence over separate operations. For example, by 918, one of her qahramanat was in charge of the grievance court, where commoners could come to seek justice. Although this is rightly condemned as scandalous overreach in our sources, I'm happy to report that she did a good job. This wasn't the despicable Umm Musa. Shaghab's other qahramanat were terrible, some numbering among the Ummah's most corrupt actors. But back to Ibn al-Jarrah. The wazir tried his best to balance the books, except decline was accelerating at an unsustainable pace. One record from early in al-Muqtadir's reign describes revenue collected from Egypt, Syria, Mesopotamia, Khorasan, Khuzestan, and Fadis. By this point, Ibn al-Jarrah was having trouble collecting taxes in Iraq, and it doesn't look like any of the other provinces were contributing. The reliance on tax farming had led to the rise of wealthy landowners, and it seems to be a timeless truth that growing economic disparity means the state collects less revenue, as the rich are much harder to tax than us regular folks. To keep the treasury from going bust, Ibn al-Jarrah paid out only 10 months of the year in salaries for multiple years in a row, leading to a chorus of voices calling for his removal. After resisting their demands for some months, the 28-year-old al-Muqtadir finally caved in 923. As was customary during his corrupt reign, the position was sold to the highest bidder, and nobody wanted it more than Ibn al-Furat. Giving it to him may not seem like a particularly bad decision, considering that he was the only other official capable enough to do the job. But the trauma inflicted upon the man had turned him into something darker. Ibn al-Furat paid 500,000 dinar to become wazir number 7. He put his son in charge of the dispossession of the ex-wazir. There was serious bad blood between those two. Remember, number 6 had ordered the torture of the son to put pressure on the father. Well, Ibn al-Furat's son paid back the favor with interest, and he quickly gained a reputation for unrestrained brutality. Now that Ibn al-Furat was back in power, he had plenty of scores to settle, and we find multiple horror stories of dispossessions under duress. We also hear about the downfall of Umm Musa, Shaghab's long-time qahramana. She'd grown rich during her long years of service to the Queen Mother, and Shaghab hired an ex-torturer to both dispossess and replace her. Regime figures turning on one another for money gives an impression that the caliphate's finances were in dire straits. Ibn al-Furat's cruelty was not what ended his brief third tenure. After all, such behavior had become par for the course. The removal of Ibn al-Jarrah meant that the Qaramita were no longer being paid to keep the peace, and the Bahrain-based insurgents united behind a savage new leader, one of the younger sons of their founder al-Jannabi. They resumed their raids against the Hajj caravans, leading to public outrage at the caliphate's inability to protect the pilgrims. Ibn al-Furat's enemies scapegoated the wazir, and one of them made the case to al-Muqtadir that he could do a better job, supporting his argument with a cool 2,000,000 dinar. Wazir number 8 was actually the son of the super-corrupt wazir number 3. Some accounts make it sound like the court was excited at the prospect of his appointment because his father had lavished riches on everyone back in the day. You should be able to guess his first orders by now. They were the arrest and dispossession of Ibn al-Furat and his son. Ibn al-Furat's son had become inured to pain, and he did not part with a single dinar. When the new wazir despaired from extracting any wealth from the pair, he ordered they be executed. Ibn al-Furat was over 70 years old, and his son was in his early 30s. Things didn't go well for number 8 after that. Another of the Ummah's rich men whispered promises of wealth into the caliph's ear and replaced him only a year later. Wazir number 9 was a good-for-nothing drunkard who didn't even bother to check his inbox. He only lasted a year before the alarming financial situation prompted the caliph to rehire Ibn al-Jarrah as wazir number 10. The seasoned official once again busied himself with fighting graft, and his third and final tenure started out relatively well. The dispossession of number 9 and his cronies yielded enough money to pay both the troops and the Qaramita, something which brought peace to the troubled caliphate. Ibn al-Jarrah investigated army expenses closely and found that corruption had become pervasive in the military, with thousands of salaries being paid out to ghost soldiers. His purse pinching during a time of privation meant Ibn al-Jarrah's approach made him few friends, and he was ultimately unseated by the big dog herself. Shaghab pressured her son to replace the wazir with a more friendly figure, and al-Muqtadir finally relented in 928, ordering the arrest of Ibn al-Jarrah and his brother. Wazir number 11 was one of Shaghab's agents, and he openly lamented how foolish it was for him to accept the position, saying he made more money working for the Queen Mother instead. He managed to hold down the role for over 2 years on account of his strong relationship to both Shaghab and Mu'nis. Number 10 clearly knew how the game was played, because he had been making regular payments to the general for a long time. A pretty major dispute exploded between the caliph and General Mu'nis in the year 930. We'll talk about it another time, but basically, the years after 928 were volatile because renewed attacks by the Qaramita put pressure on an unprepared government. The aftermath led to a reshuffle, and number 11 was replaced by Mu'nis's choice of wazir. Number 12 was supposed to learn the ropes from the imprisoned Ibn al-Jarrah, but he never got the hang of things and had to be removed a little over a year into his tenure when he proved to be a hopeless case. Mu'nis then forced a different candidate on the caliph, but number 13 only lasted a little over 2 months. He was dismissed because number 14 paid the caliph's favorite fortune teller to recommend him for the job. He was pretty terrible as well, and was removed only 7 months into it. His replacement, number 15, was appointed in May 932, only 5 months before al-Muqtadir's reign came to a bloody end. Okay, that was a long and somewhat bewildering list. But now that we've gone through the caliph's full 24 years in charge, I hope you have a better idea why Ibn al-Furat and Ibn al-Jarrah were the only two wazirs who mattered, and what their purported rivalry was like. They did sort of compete for the role, but as the only competent officials to get the job, the pair were on the same side in another, more important sense. While all the other wazirs were exclusively focused on enriching themselves, Ibn al-Furat and Ibn al-Jarrah actually tried to keep the state solvent. The latter is credited for his effort in our sources, but the former is not. Instead, Ibn al-Furat is mainly remembered for the ruinous year of his final tenure. I find that kind of unfair, and I'd like to do a little bit to help rehabilitate his image. Consider this. Ibn al-Furat started his career as a simple official, just a guy who wanted to work with his brother and follow in their father's footsteps. When Qasim effectively took over the state and blackballed them during al-Muqtafi's days, Ibn al-Furat took that lesson to heart. He tried to emulate Qasim when he first became wazir in 909, empowering loyalists to make himself indispensable. I have no doubt that if he was left in office, the state's financial situation would have only improved. Instead, the caliph fired and dispossessed him for not being indulgent enough with public funds. This is the point at which a wiser man may have walked away. But Ibn al-Furat persevered. He once again sought to adapt in order to achieve a sustainable hold on office. He should have known that his corrupt deal with the avaricious ruling family would not save him. They sold him down the river the minute someone else offered them more money. His replacement provided the horrific climax to Ibn al-Furat's origin story as a villain. By torturing his son, the wazir traumatized Junior and turned him into a psycho, and Senior into a vengeful father hell-bent on inflicting the same pain on those who benefited from his fall. That's exactly what he did in 923. He turned a blind eye to the resurgent threat of the Qaramata and single-mindedly pursued the persecution of his enemies. Just like Ibn al-Furat is unfairly remembered for his worst qualities, Ibn al-Jarrah is remembered for his best. I leaned into all the material that describes him as a straight arrow. It really is the majority of stuff we find on the man, but other accounts highlight some of his more negative aspects. He was quite rigid in character, and at times downright mean, the kind of uncompromising man whose standards could never be met. It's not a terrible reputation. I guess I'm just trying to discourage anyone from romanticizing the pair as a villain and a paragon. They were just two dedicated officials serving a decaying institution. We've covered a lot today. Surveying the considerable corruption of al-Muqtadir's reign was no small task. The caliphate went from prosperous to broke, as the ruling family greedily hollowed it out, assisted by a throng of opportunists and sycophants. It's not like all our previous caliphs were well chosen or anything, but al-Muqtadir is on another level altogether. He was nowhere near prepared for the job, and his mother used corruption to run the show straight into the ground. Her graft earned her overwhelming influence throughout the realm, but ironically could not free her from the confines of her harem. The corruption was only self-destructive in an abstract sense for her. She enjoyed a comfortable life and unofficial but very real authority. Next time, we'll round out al-Muqtadir's reign by focusing on the armies and their relationships to the state and the Abbasids. Here on The Caliphs, the rise and fall of Arab power.